that. So for today's class on cybersphere and John Doe, we have all the guests right here in the flesh with us. So it might make sense to start with some introductions this way. So going not the order that John has up, let's just start with Terry. We have a match protocol here. You can push the button and then you're going to land on. Of course, it doesn't. Does anyone need lights working? It's just this part of the room. Mics are on. Alright, well, I guess you guys are either going to have to go or you're going to have to go. So, Terry, why don't you tell us about yourself, and in the spirit of this class, while you tell us about yourself, I'm going to ask John to do a Google search on Terry Weston. Let's see what pops up.
We want to go.
So as you can tell, Terry is an interesting character. He is referred to as somebody I just said is a gumshoe. Is it fair to call you a gumshoe?
No, I'm a lawyer.
You're a lawyer. And what is your law practice entail?
Fact finding.
Yeah. Fact finding analysis. What's the name of your group?
The investigative group.
So when the phone rings to the investigative group, typically what does the caller want?
Information.
And you are the guy who. You have to pay him to get information, you see. He's very sparing. It's just for free. Pay him to pay him. Except for tonight, all will be able to use the Google search. Terry Lester, CIA connection from the Republic, Clinton Secret Police, Winter of S38, the WHO report, and Terry Lester refused Morris allegations. That was like a great Morris who was making various wild eyes allegations. And I think your own site appears to be down. Try to go to your homepage on the IGI site and save no information. That's it.
So we do a website.
You do a website. Yeah, there it is. That page cannot be found.
You gave me the wrong URL when you told me what this website was. I did a search and found
it. Well, there's the front door of the investigative group. And we are district number 6314. Of course, there's many more of us than that, so we'll have to adjust the number manually. Okay, so that's Terry Lester. Bruce Fishman. Who are you?
I am Bruce Fishman. I'm a lawyer from Miami, Florida. And we have a boutique law firm in Miami that primarily represents large public companies and individuals who have been defamed on the internet. We have spoken quite a bit to Fortune 500 companies. I was a speaker at the Fortune 500 conference this year. I was a speaker at the Cyber Crimes Conference in Miami with the Department of Justice. And we have been successful as of Thursday in what we believe to be setting precedent in the United States dealing with John Doe.
Now, how long has it been something you would call a boutique? Practice of protecting companies with defamation on
it? I would say 1 year.
1 year, yeah, this is a fairly recent phenomenon. Now, Bruce on his website, which I think is fhdlaw.com, has a list of the various engagements he does. His visit to our class is, of course, at the top of the news right now. On that site, I don't know if it's under news.
You have to go? Yeah, I think you're on
five. Oh, yeah, just go to fhdlaw.com.
As
a result of his mentioning he was coming to class, that drove some people to our class website and then emailed me. And I just want to read you a couple of the emails I got regarding today's class. Here is email number one. Email number one says, you may already know that Mr. Bruce Fishman is carving quite a reputation for himself as an attorney who tracks down the identities of anonymous posters. However, what happens when these anonymous posters are simply warning consumers about ongoing internet scams, and there are many of them, what happens then? It's my contention that Bruce Fishman's representation of the internet now company BigSmart.com is simply an attempt to provide a restraint, et cetera, et cetera. So it turns out this is from a John Doe. He says, I'm a John Doe who's been intimidated by BigSmart's Gestapo-like tactics to silence their online critics. Please email me at this address if I can provide any further information. Sincerely, John Doe. So this is interesting. So I, of course, had Becca write back to John Doe here and say, how interesting, you know, that sort of thing. And I think Becca even mayor experimented with the idea that he wanted to be in a chat room today to discuss things with the class. And he wrote back, he said, "I hesitate to take part in your class. The simple reason is that Mr. Bruce Mitchell will not hesitate to subpoena your computer system administrators in order to trace the ISP numbers of people who participated." Is that true?
You already have.
He does a landing over at ITS right now. We may find it useful actually to take a look at the bigsmart.com site and the site that this guy apparently runs, worldwidescam.com. Worldwidescam.com, this guy is. Apparently not even that one. I got another email from a guy that says, "Congratulations on inviting Bruce Fishman to speak. He's doing what some money to do for a long time to help civilize the internet. I've been on the internet for 15 years, and computer networks for 5 years prior to that, and at no time has he been more important and useful than now. Without responsibility, anyone can say anything, but the harm is immeasurable. Sincerely, Kate McGough from pnews.org." It turns out if you go to the Worldwide Scam site, Hank Roth is vilified and made fun of later on in it. Oh yeah, there's a link for Hank the Doll Roth. I have those respected comments of Bruce Fishman, so he's consistent in his view, and this is a site that has something to say. So this is an entire world you may not know about that we're going to be seeing and learning about today. Paul Levy, tell us about yourself.
I'm a public interest lawyer with Public Citizen Litigation Group in Washington. I am really a labor lawyer. Basically, I represent dissidents and unions. For the last year, I would say, I've been engaged as well in a cyber law practice representing people who run websites like worldwidescam.com, although I don't have to represent them, I can refer to them, as well as various John Doe's who did the subject of the subpoenas. I've never been opposite Mr. Fishman,
Bruce Keller.
I'm with Deborah Poison Clinton in New York. I oversee the intellectual property practice as a result of that. We have lots of internet-related cases, both for companies that are pure internet play companies and also for a lot of traditional companies that are now distributing their content on the internet, including professional sports leagues and a lot of major newspapers around the country. As a result of that work, we get involved in John Doe's here from time to time, contacting clients like the document.
And it's also true that the company you were a lawyer in the Total News case. Right? You were the ones going after the Total News on this appropriation.
I would not have put them in that, but that's right.
Yes, well, that's a primary thing to note. Yes. Wonderful. I've also been alerted that we'll have a reception after this class immediately out those doors with some cold cuts. You probably can guess where they're going to come from, but they are free, and you're all invited a chance to interact with our guests a little bit more. So, okay, I'd love to start with Terry, because Terry, I consider you to be perhaps commonly the first line of defense. Somebody is at a company and they get news one way or the other that there is some rumor bouncing around the chat room, their stock has gone down 45% in one day, they have no idea why until they connect up to this chat room today, and they want information, right? What typically will happen in that case?
Well, actually, a lot of companies won't be monitoring the chat room, which I find sort of amazing today. And I talked to a company that had the largest increase in short position last month and said, was there misinformation being disseminated on your company? And they said, we don't want to look back on it. Well, typically, the company doesn't know what's going on. They have a suspicion that it could be there's some economic operational event that sends a corporation to us. The stock has gone up. The short position has increased. Somebody may be accumulating large blocks of stock, which may look like a hostile takeover is about to take place. Or a lawsuit is filed to escalate the transfer of a security into common stock. And if the stock price has gone down, then the individual will take a larger volume of common stock. And if it is in anticipation of hostile takeover, then they will part a greater volume of stock at a reduced price. And what we will do is first try to examine the pattern of communications on either Yahoo, or if the company's on Raging Bull or Silicon Investor, try to identify the repetitive patterns of communications, which ones look to us based on our experience as people who may have an interest in harming the company's economic situation, or they may admit that they're short. Does everybody know a short seller? A short seller is an investor who is betting that the stock price will go down over a period of time. They're actually borrowing the stock, and they have to buy it if the stock price doesn't comply with their prediction. And I think maybe the easiest way to sum this up is to talk about a recent case we were involved in, where the company called us because their chairman had been impersonated in the last quarter of 1999, predicting quarterly results to be 50% less than what they had said they were going to be. And the stock lost about 40% of its value in 2 weeks for a total of several hundred million dollars of net worth. At the same time, they had issued an exotic security called the Threshold Appreciation Series, which was supposed to terminate in about 18 months from that date, and they were being sued in the state court of California to be put into bankruptcy, because an act of bankruptcy, they argued, was going to trigger the an escalated date for conversion. In addition to the fact that they impersonated the chairman, we thought they were conducting this litigation. Now, we wanted to identify, obviously, the people who were promoting the scheme. And one of our vendors, I'll just raise two or three issues that we talked about. One of our vendors came to us and said, and they're in the technological world, and said, we have a internet probe that we can send out as a Trojan horse, which will identify who is sending these emails out under anonymous names. And we've checked it out, and it's all legal, and there's no problem. And it works. What sounds, when it brought to my attention, it sounds to be fraught with risk. And indeed, I called Jonathan up for some free legal advice. We both concluded that it apparently was going to be in violation of these three federal statutes. So we went back to our standard methodology, which is basically taking an offline computer so we can't be identified by our physical site. And we locate our computer off our premises. And then we have a dialogue with people that are putting up negative communications, trying to get into a conversation with them through the computer that will help us identify who they are and where they are, whether they're broker-dealers that are in violation of NASDAQ and SEC rules by not disclosing that they're trying to affect and manipulate the stock of price without disclosing the fact that they're broker-dealers. In this case, we were surprised because in one of our dialogues, the anonymous individual said, and let me just back up a second, we go offline with them because we don't want to influence discussions on the internet websites lest we damage our own company's economic situation. One of the things that we will say is we're interested in taking a large short position. Why are you so convinced that this is a company that should be shorted? And then we hope that they'll give us enough information to support their credibility to convince us to short the stock as well. In this case, the anonymous Doe said, well, I know that this company is not suing, Well, you sued him for, well, because we're trying to put him into bankruptcy in California, so now we've gone full circle, and we've ended up communicating with one of the very plaintiffs who was trying to trigger the escalate date for the conversion of the securities. And so the question became, what should we do and what can we do at that point?
Because there actually could be some lawyer client issues.
Yes, in other words, if in fact they don't know it's insured, whether this individual is a plaintiff, he could be making that up to convince us that he can buy out a company, therefore we should join in short attack. Short attack, and then, of course, the more short position there is, the more the stock is going to sink.
And for those of you who have already taken professional ethics, of course, professional counsel, you'll recall that it's not the best idea if you're a lawyer for one side to contact the principals on the other side, but to go through their lawyers if you want to talk with them once you know that they're represented and you're in some adversarial relationship. So at this point, the question is, do you need to continue? What I guess is a fabrication, right? I mean, if you lie to them, there's no bones about it.
We lie to them?
Well, you said that you're interested.
Yes, no, but we call that a pretext. We don't call that a lie.
Would you call that a lie, or is the pretext a pretext?
Yes, that's both right.
Yes. All right. Let me just ask quickly of Paul. So far, the techniques we've been talking about are ones that don't rise to the level of the election. This is just being a little street smart, going on, trying to influence your John Doe's, and get them to disgorge some information that you can then hit them hard with. Do you have any problem with this so far?
Not at all. And the argument we make is an argument based on the First Amendment, so when the state gets involved. If the state's not involved, then it's a matter of private communication. It seems to me a perfectly intelligent thing to do. Company to do to communicate with their adversaries. If the purpose of the communication is to attract them to reveal who they are, well, people abuse their activity, there's no question about it. And I have no problem with trying to get it.
So the sense we have that, you know, there's somebody in a chat room talking about sex is probably an FBI agent talking to another FBI agent trying to get together. And at this chat, they're emailing each other, well, I want to shoot the stock too, but it's actually the other private investigator and I. You have no idea.
Yeah, I like what they used to say about the members of the company. It's funny, they're all FBI agents trying to catch each other for a terrible fail.
And God bless them, that's the okay. So then at some point, if these tools don't work, you have a more clever than not so clever John Doe out there who's doing something a company believes to be damaging or trying to find out the identity. Presumably so, there's something illegal going on. You can refer the information to the proper authorities and get them prosecuted, or perhaps there's some lawsuit you could launch. If they are good at still avoiding having to disclose their identity, I guess is the next step then moves to a lawsuit of some kind?
Question.
Well, why do you think it moves to somebody who often initiates such things?
The short answer is yes. Although I'd like to supplement what Terry indicated, I think that in addition to these methodologies that are used of trying to engage in these offline conversations, the John Doe's are getting much more sophisticated than they used to be. John Doe's are using anonymizers at this juncture. They're using every methodology that they can configure to avoid your ability to detect them. Just to supplement what he said, methodology that we use is something called silent fingerprint. We'll actually historically check communications up to a year and a half on websites, on Usenet, on other areas of the web, in order to develop patterns of speech. Because people that write typically write in the same pattern. If you look at your notes from yesterday, you're going to use a lot of the same phrases today. So they may not have been as careful 6 months ago on the Viad bulletin as they were on House House. And oftentimes we're successful without the necessity of filing a John Doe suit in detecting this way. But if
in fact, it is unsuccessful, and if they have committed defamation or intentional interference with that advantageous business relationship or some other tort, then, in fact, they will file a lawsuit to serve the internet provider with a subpoena for identifying information and track down on their web.
So to get clear what you're saying on the first point, it sounds like you're saying there may be software for which, if I participate in two Usenet groups, we talked about Usenet last session, so I participate in, you know, alt.flame.ihatedisney and say all sorts of scandalous things about Disney and be careful not to reveal my name there, but I also happen to participate in rec.arts.aquaria, and there I'm talking about my fish tank and I happily get my name there to fellow aquarians. You're saying this software can actually detect enough pattern because I use the same kinds of words or grammar or something, then it will tie me back to my parenting conversation if you've got enough need to...
Yes. And we, in fact, do that as well. It's not that hard to do.
You can run it, right? You don't have to hire Terry to do it.
I don't need Terry to do that.
God, I thought Terry's actually taking notes at the time. So, you then launch a suit. You launch it against a named John Doe, which is to say you're not blaming Yahoo, say, as a legal matter for something that appears on a Yahoo Club, which includes a message board, even if that message is allegedly defamatory to your client or otherwise prescribed by law. You're not saying Yahoo is to blame. You're naming John Doe as a sole defendant and then using that as a vehicle for which to launch a subpoena at Yahoo and say, you have some information to be helpful in the suit, please turn it over. Is that right?
Partially, a little history would be useful, I think, to play out.
Sure.
The Communications Decency Act, which was passed in 1996, exempts internet service providers, those that provide the service for the host from liability for defamation by another, by a publisher. So although I would love to, and especially the first week I started doing this for a living, I would love to just file my lawsuit against Yahoo, I realized that Congress wanted to expand the internet. And they figured that if Yahoo may well have to be policemen on the internet, then the internet would not expand. I don't think their interest was protecting the First Amendment, their interest was expanding the internet.
So this is section 230C of the CDA, right? This should ring a bell. It's not here.
Correct. But it's interesting to note that what Congress did not do was to exempt the publishers of the information from liability. Thus, one has to file a lawsuit against the publisher for some tort and proceed. Now, you're suing someone who's unknown.
By the publisher, you mean the author, the person who actually
is. And they publish because they have to get their book on the computer and send
it. Transmit it to a third party or a multiple third party.
Yes. And so you have a problem under the rules of civil procedure in those jurisdictions. It's somewhat difficult to get judgment against someone if you haven't brought them in the process. You haven't served them in the process because you don't know who they are.
Sort of in absentia.
Yes. And it's difficult. We have been successful in convincing the courts that a John Doe or John Doe suits are the appropriate methodology or favored by the court in flushing out a person with an identity with an address that you can take your complaint, serve them with process, bring them into the system, and give the court jurisdiction over the court.
So, Bruce, suppose you work for Yahoo, or let's be completely hypothetical, you work for Shmahoo, and Shmahoo gets a nice letter on Bruce's stationery saying, you'll note the following Captain Case to file in both the Superior Court here. It's against John Doe. We believe you have information since it appears in one of your club areas of bearing on this case. And we work with, under the proper rules of procedure, order you to turn over all information they help us identify such person. And they now come to you and say, all right, you're our lawyer. What do we do?
Well, there's a couple of issues lurking around in this hypothetical. First, John Doe lawsuits are not new, and they're not a function of the internet. People have been bringing John Doe lawsuits against unidentifiable parties at the time of the inception of the suit for decades. And it's a time-honored tradition. You're allowed to do it. There's nothing
clear on what the cause of action is against John or Jane Doe. And sometimes when you're bringing these actions in state court, you don't even need to file a complaint to start the discovery process. And that's where the process lends itself sometimes to the possibility of abuse. You're the ISP, and you've got a business to run, and you've got limited immunity under the CDA. But as Bruce points out, there's no immunity from the discovery process, there's no immunity for the publisher. So you have to think about this. What are we going to do? We can't ignore this. But we also can't turn around and just flip over all this information, which, by the way, sometimes is not particularly illuminating, because in the case of Schmalm, you can get an email account about ever identifying really who you are. But you get these requests on a constant basis now because of all the interactivity and all of the messages that are taking people off about companies that are being transmitted coast to coast and internationally. Well, if you're a responsible ISP, the last thing you want to do is have your subscribers think that you'll just flip over all of the information at the drop of a hat, particularly in the case of a lawsuit that's either not particularly well spelled out or hasn't even been started by the filing of a complaint, or somehow some pre-discovery process has been initiated. Well, most ISPs today that think about the issue suddenly have to take some sort of balanced approach to this. So they will give, rather than responding to the subpoena right away, they will give a 2-week, 15-day period to the poster. They'll give notice, we have gotten a subpoena in connection with this particular action pending in this particular jurisdiction. And if you do not move to quash the subpoena, which you're obviously entitled to do under any state's law, we will be turning this information over to you in about 15 days' time. Now, that's not the way it was for many ISPs as recently as, say, a year ago. But given the flood of these John or Jane Doe suits, which although have been around for some time and used in other contexts, are becoming more prevalent in this situation, you've got to come up with a policy that strikes a balance. Because if you're going to just turn over all the information willy-nilly, you're going to lose a lot of subscribers. They're not going to be real happy about the efforts you've taken to preserve whatever degree of anonymity they've tried to create for themselves online.
So Bruce, would you agree with that, that it's gotten harder over time to pry open the clamshell of an ISP and get the pearl out that might be information that would lead to the identity of John Doe?
I think it's harder now than it was, but I am in full support of the notice policies that the ISPs are now using. One of the criticisms that we always received in these lawsuits is that the John Doe's are being denied due process because they don't know about the subpoena. The contractual relationship between John Doe is with the office. It's not our place to go ahead and notify a potential John Doe that he may be that there may be a subpoena out there that affects him. It's the responsibility of his contracting party, in this case, Yahoo, to do it. So I think it's a great thing that the ISPs are now notified.
I suppose if you go by the hour, it makes for a more not be cynical about it, of course, but it joins the battle a little more fully rather than just getting the information in
the
way.
The whole goal is to try to get a defendant by name into the process and have a court that has the control over that person render a judgment.
Gotcha.
That's the goal.
So, Jenny, can you hear me here? Jenny, here you are. You're on our panel today, right? So, suppose you are John Doe or Jane Doe, Jenny Doe even, and you've just gotten a nice little phone call from a guy who was at the Bruce Geller law firm, and he, works with your internet service provider, and it turns out the request has been lodged for information about you because something you said in the chat room on his service was sensitive to Mr. Fishman. Now, would you, by the way, in alerting Jenny Tools, would you tell him the identity of the person seeking the subpoena, or would you say there's a subpoena out there?
Well, no, we'll give specific notice so that people know exactly what the issue is, and because without that, then you can't make motion to watch.
Got it. So it's going to be Bruce Fishman representing so-and-so, and then she's maybe going to call.
Notices, yeah. What the notices actually do is they say there's such and such an attorney who serves me. That often doesn't give the case name, the client name, just the name of the attorney, and say contact the attorney for information.
I mean, there are those notices. Actually, we had a job note that sent us back one of those notices with his real name on it. And he said,
I want to watch.
No, he said, come take my truck.
Did you hit the sky?
No.
You know, it's kind of across the mail, it'd be clear for surprise.
There's actually another kind of notice that has developed at least recently in one case, and something we think is a great idea, which is that a judge in a New Jersey case got one of these requests for pre-litigation discovery and ordered the plaintiff to publish on the message board the notice, a copy of the order. Basically, this is the file, you don't come into my court to oppose the granting of an order, giving permission to the plaintiff to issue a subpoena to Yahoo, I'm going to grant that order. And also gave the telephone number of the local board of prosecutors.
And that was a way of alerting whoever was on the board. If that happens to be you out there, don't know.
Because one of the problems you have is, not that I don't know that the judge would talk this through, but since people do give false information about themselves, figuring that this is one way to protect their anonymity, at least if you monitor the message board, you'll find out that the chain of ISPs is starting to get to you, and then, of course, you have a decision to make. Should I respond to the process you want?
Gotcha. Because as Bruce Kay mentioned, the ISP may not have information that leads to the identity of John Doe because John Doe put in bogus information. So this is a way of alerting John Doe that they're hot on the trail and not there yet, and this is the time they need to.
Yeah, we have one case that we just filed, which filed a motion quash, in which the person gave a screen name that he then stopped their using. So it wasn't really because of any bad intent that they gave bad information to Yahoo. They just gave information that ceased to be useful for this person's purpose by the time the subpoena came around.
So, Jenny, suppose you just got to this notice sent, and you had your wits about you enough to say, gee, maybe I should talk to a lawyer before I call up Bruce and, you know, muffle my voice, trying to hide my identity, just in case go away. And you read an article that said that Paul Beebe often takes these cases in Public Citizen. What's the conversation you're going to have? You just play telephone catalog, you finally reach them on the line. What do you want to know?
I guess I
want to
know.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
What the possible consequences of not watching this dinner with you?
Let's have a conversation.
Okay. Would you recommend watching this dinner and if not, why not?
Well, first of all, I'm in a somewhat different place than a lawyer in private practice because I work for public interest group with very limited resources. I'm not going to decide to get involved in your situation based on whether you can be or not. I would like to get involved in your situation based on whether I think you have a situation that deserves to be protected.
The first question you might ask her is, what did you say?
Oh, and the other point is, certainly, we're trying to make the law here. We're trying to, Bruce doesn't have any good elaborated decisions which explain why it's okay to reveal people's identities. He's got tons of successes, and other people all over the country have tons of successes. But what the courts haven't done is grappled with this problem and elaborated on the rationale for distinguishing either denying the subpoena enforcement in some cases or figuring out when to grant, when to deny it. Our objective is to help the courts to craft a sexual standard. And you're not going to do that in a case where somebody's been accused of being a Nazi doctor back in the 1930s and 1940s. You're probably not going to do that in a case in which somebody is posted things, we take one of Bruce's cases, saying that the person's committed Medicare fraud and, by the way, I'm sleeping with his wife.
It wasn't mine, it was the CEO.
Yeah, I don't know. I hope that was implicit. So, we're looking at cases with good facts. And so the first question I'm going to ask is, what did you say? I'm going to ask for a complete set of everything you said on the message board, not just the things that are named in the litigation, identified litigation, if any, and there aren't always been specified in the litigation. I want to know everything you said so I can make a judgment. Are you a client that I'm not to represent or not?
Do you want to know who she is?
I think the first question for me is, what did they say? I think before I form an attorney-client relationship, I would, before I take the case on, obviously there's an attorney-client relationship as soon as I'm leaving the advice. But before I take on a case, I would want to talk a little bit more about the person. For example, I think that making a good law in this area, it's best to have people who are obviously subject to economic retaliation if they're identified.
Okay, so an example of a wrong answer, Jenny, might be, I was behind on my student loans, I found a company, I put up a few just bogus, silly things about it, having shorted some of the stock the day before, it went down 20%, I closed my position, I made $2,000, no harm, no foul.
I've received some calls from people who, although not so egregious, are at least in the ballpark there. And my advice to people like that, and of course, it's always accompanied with protestations of innocence. After all, they want a free lawyer. But my advice is, get a real lawyer. Get somebody who's sophisticated in the criminal area, who can give you guidance about what your real exposure is, because you have some serious decisions to make.
Okay, but Jenny, you didn't do that, right?
Right.
I mean, you just were saying something about your summer employer, who had given you an offer to come back to the firm. And you had just said a few things about, frankly, what a crappy place the firm was. And you said it on a board, and then just a lot of law students were talking. That was the sort of thing you did, right?
Yeah.
Is that more interesting to you?
Yeah.
All right, so what else do you want to know? She's just told you what the deal is. It sounds like it might be a case worth taking. Are you curious about anything else?
I guess if the ISP has to give away my identity, assuming I have my voter's name or whatever, then, you know, I have somebody who said to do it without my name and where my IP is associated and what my name is and what my server is.
So you're asking technical questions, you Paul.
Well, I would actually ask a series of questions that relate to the technical thing. I would ask, what does the ISP had on you, but it's Yahoo, for example. Generally speaking, I think it's good, it's advantageous to be responding to a subpoena to Yahoo rather than to your local ISP at New Jersey, for example, because if you're in the California courts, you've got to slash that which you can take a look at. It's a possible additional claim that you can make in addition to the first
one. So I want to hear about SLAP in a second. But just to be clear, what he just packed in as a technical matter, think of the internet cloud, the cascade of ISPs between you and the data you're sending and the rest of the world. Yahoo may be a site with which you are communicating, where you send out a message, and then others who visit Yahoo see it. But the only way that message gets to Yahoo is through your own internet service provider. You're probably not paying Yahoo for that. You are paying BU1 or ATP or Mindstream or something. And there may even be a way in which Yahoo has information that would let Bruce jump back to BU1 and then send a subpoena there. And he's saying there are some state-by-state variations in which Yahoo is a better term to publish a client than your actual home.
And there are some ISPs that don't give notice. In fact, Yahoo has only been giving notice since I think it's April of this year. I was pursued by somebody who, with respect to the notice I wasn't given. I understand they actually adopted their policy before that lawsuit was filed. But there are ISPs out there which aren't good about giving notice. And so obviously, if you've got an ISP like that, you've got no choice but to stand and defend yourself at the Yahoo. Another question I want to try to figure out is, does the court in which the case is pending have jurisdiction over you? Because you have, obviously, if you enter an appearance as a doe in the originating court, it's often difficult to do that. That is to say, you oppose the issuance of the subpoena. It may well be difficult to do that without accepting personal jurisdiction in that court. So,
can you deny personal jurisdiction, say I'm not a citizen of the state, even though you don't know who I am? I have heard that I don't live here, even though I'm telling you who I am and where my address is.
Well, if you think there's some question about whether they're going to be able to track you down or track you down quickly, on the one subject to jurisdiction. On the other hand, if you're sued in New Jersey, you can move to Washington, West Jersey. It's difficult to do that as a Dutchman, obviously, because the first thing the plaintiff wants to do is take your debt to see what the extent of your contract is. But it's certainly something that I want to be plaintiff to think about. Yeah. And I've been in the situation of advising somebody, oh, it's probably not a good idea for you to enter an opposition here because you may well have a good objection to the jurisdiction. So why don't you wait and see whether they can figure out who you are?
Gotcha. So I'd love to hear about the SLAP, but let's see if your reference has to use on the jurisdiction question, too. Very practical question. But tell us about SLAP.
Well, in California and in some other states, there is a statute which makes it easier for a defendant in a case, and the formulations vary, but basically it's a case that's brought over public participation. California's got the broadest statute, and what public participation is has been defined very broadly, probably broadly enough to include participation in the investment board by the corporation. Although I don't think the issues were litigated, you know, we got to the point of maybe litigating and then the company gave up. And the remedies vary. In California,
at least as far as it goes, it doesn't part of the sentence. That makes it easier for a defendant in a case brought over public participation. What does that mean exactly?
I'm not sure. Get rid of the case.
Got it.
In California, you file a motion to dismiss, a special motion to strike, it's called. And what the plaintiff then has the burden of not only meeting the 12b6 type standard, but also coming in with sufficient evidence to show that they have a reasonable probability of success on the merits. So it's nailed between summary judgment and a motion to dismiss that puts the plaintiff to a higher standard. And if you get the case dismissed under the SLAP statute, the anti-SLAP statute, I suppose one should say, you get an award of trade fees.
The idea is basically to have an extra bite against frivolous litigation.
And in one case that we handled, in which somebody had come online after a company's stock dropped to 40% and said, well, maybe it's because they adopted this stupid order taking system. Why don't we go back to the old one, the person being an employee, and the company sued a bunch of posters, including what ended up being our client. I have no question that the reason the company ultimately dismissed the case with a statement that came close to being an apology for bringing the case in the first place is that we were able to file that next slap action.
Bruce, is there some tactics here that make sense? You don't want to go after something in California and make a comment?
Well, we don't care what's going on. First thing we do when we look at a case is to see whether we feel that the case has merit.
We feel that it is arguable that we're dealing with defamation or some other tort. The second thing is, and what I'd like to get at is the jurisdictional issue, because especially as we address a law class, I think the jurisdictional issue is fascinating. The case that was decided by the Third District Court of Appeals in Miami, Florida on Thursday, which was John Doe versus Vida at 3D00-1693, Third District Court of Appeals, and October 12, 2000, a writ of certiorari was taken by a number of John Doe's claiming that this issue of the right to defend the case anonymously was a matter of national importance. And the Third District Court of Appeals agreed to hear the case. There was oral argument. The American Civil Liberties Union took up the cause of the John Doe's. And all issues were argued before the Third District, as they were in the lower court, jurisdiction, the First Amendment, rights of anonymity on the internet, and the ruling, and it is not instructive in the sense that the court did not expound on why they did what they did. They denied the writ of cert, they lifted the stay, and they basically said the names will be revealed by Yahoo and by AOL. But in the lower court, we argued to the judge that it's a 22 situation. How is it that you court can order these unknown people to do anything? How is it that these unknown people can file an appeal of an order when they submitted to the jurisdiction of the court?
They haven't said, "Court, you have the power to rule over me, therefore I will honor your rulings."
This sounds like the International Court of Justice, where it's okay to mine the harbors that we agree with jurisdiction, but it's not.
Okay, exactly, exactly. And it's a double bite of the apple, which is what the lower court said. The suggestion by the American Civil Liberties Union was that you pre-trial the case. In essence, what you do is you allow these unnamed defendants to come into court and challenge by motion to dismiss or motion for summary judgment whether the complaint itself is sufficient as a matter of law, and then on summary judgment as a matter of fact. And if it survives those things, then it only then can you get the names of the John Does. And the appellate court took the position, no, you don't have to jump through hoops.
But let's ask, I want to, because we're starting to engage on merits, you know, all right, you want to watch the subpoena, what do you say? That maybe you convince the court to do it, what do you say back? And the court, no reason to apply. And maybe we should cut that, but I just want to ask maybe some professional responsibility questions. Suppose you have a client that comes to you and says, we have somebody who seems to have knowledge no only employee would have. Not trade secret, nothing like that, let's be clear. But, you know, it's clearly somebody that's hung around, knows the color of our carpet, that sort of thing. And they're saying terrible things about the company. If I find out who that jerk is, he or she is fired, of course. And pension is out the window, too. But, of course, I have no making legal claim against them. I can't say they're saying something defamatory, but I heard that maybe I can file the case, issue a subpoena, find out who they are, fire them, and then drop the case. What's your take on that? Is that perfectly valid?
I think it's invalid. I'll give you an example. And I can't mention the name of the public company. Public company with 6,000 locations. The CEO calls me up during the national conference of the public company because 15 minutes after he spoke on Yahoo was their business plan for the coming year. So needless to say, he was quite upset because all his competitors now had a business plan. And for a voluntary open source certainly. Yeah. And he was sure that it came from an employee. So what we did was we checked the intranet. First line that you want to check when you suspect that it's an employee. And it seemed as though it came from a particular center in Michigan. And since the employee was still down in Orlando, Florida, at Disney World, it seemed as though it came from either that employee's subordinate or someone related to that employee. We quickly tracked it to the employee's husband. So we had a practical issue. We determined that this was a good employee and that the CEO did not want to terminate him.
So poor barrel judgment.
Yes. So what we did is we flew up to Michigan the next day and we met them there and we said we had a problem. We said, this incident occurred, how do you want to handle it? And she said to me, well, will you give me the name of my employee? And I said, well, if I do, what are you going to do about it? And she said, I'll counsel them. I'll have them apologize on the web, or I'll apologize to the CEO. And if they don't do it, I'll fire them. And then I quickly told them that it was her, that was sort of her husband. And I said, well, now what are you going to do? And she said, well, he sleeps on the front steps tonight, but if he doesn't apologize, I'll fire him. So there is a practical way to all of this. You don't always have to end up, as Paul and I discussed earlier, you don't have to always end up in lawsuits. The trouble with the internet is the lack of civility and honor. And if people can face each other and communicate, oftentimes these defamation issues can be used to solve.
So Paul, this one right here, in a final motion to quash the subpoena against Jenny, aka Jane Doe, what's the meat of your claim? What's the legal claim you're going to make to say this is not a lawful subpoena for the purpose of making an identification of the defendant in what seems to be a perfectly good confirmation case of defamation?
Well, you're assuming. Can you all hear me?
Yes, sir.
Okay. The meat of our argument is kind of assumed away by the way
way you frame your...
And it's a fact, the family already, then...
That's right. What we argue is, look, there is a series of cases talking about the existence of a First Amendment right to speak anonymously. And, of course, because you're talking about the issuance of a subpoena or the enforcement of a subpoena, you're speaking of using government power, state power, to deprive somebody of their anonymity because of the content of their speech. So, obviously, you've got an exercise of state power that trenches on this right to speak anonymously. And so what we do is we make the argument that because the state is trenching on the right to speak anonymously, it ought to try to balance the interests of, on the one hand, the anonymous speaker, and on the other hand, the person about whom speech has been made, and say, has the person who wants to bring the case shown that he or she has a compelling need for the information? What we do is draw by analogy from the line of cases which talk about the compelled disclosure of anonymous sources in libel litigation or elsewhere. And there are a series of other cases that talk about responses to grand jury subpoenas and identification of the members of unpopular political groups, NAACP versus Alabama, and so forth. And what the courts do is they apply the balancing test. They say, does the information sought go to the part of the case? Is there a reason to believe that the plaintiff can be successful in the case by prevailing on all the issues in the case that can be litigated without co-learning the identity of the particular defendant, or in those cases, the particular source? I certainly don't agree with Bruce that you need to know who the defendant is in order to get a good service and subject the person to the personal jurisdiction of the court. Has the person seeking the information exhausted or other ways of solving the problem? Obviously, if you've got an expression of what looks like a fact, and if the plaintiff has evidence that the fact that's been stated is false, it's difficult to mitigate a defamation case where falsity may well be established without taking the deposition of the individual and seeing whether the statement was weighed with balance, assuming we've got a public figure. Obviously, it's a different standard. You've got a different kind of plaintiff. In those certain kinds of circumstances, yes, you're going to have to identify the defendant in order to figure out who they are. On the other hand, if, as in some cases, it's kind of hard to figure out what this person said that was defamatory, I think that's a fair description of all my cases, although I'm sure the lawyers on the other side would disagree. Why take away this person's right to speak anonymously if the plaintiff doesn't have anything anyway?
So what Bruce is calling a form of pre-litigation, some pre-litigation of the sort is fine with you. That you might as well have joint battle on some aspects of the case that would be dispositive without having to disclose the name.
Right, and obviously courts articulated a variety of standards for dealing with this kind of problem, depending on how they weigh the interests. If you have somebody who might well be fired without the case ever being completed, it's easy to make the argument that this person has a particularly strong interest in not being identified.
In fact, there have been a couple of decisions, even absent the existence of an anti-slap statute in institutional jurisdiction, where courts have struck the balance by allowing sort of a almost imposing an ersatz rule on fraud pleading test on the complaint. And that's not something that's unknown in either state or federal court jurisprudence, regardless of the existence of a specific anti-slap statute. And it really depends on the quality of the pleading, because you can tell a lot of these pleadings whether or not you've got a possible bona fide tort, be it a defamation, a violation of an intellectual property right, a disclosure of a trade secret or something else. Or when you've got the situation where the company simply wants to find out who said what so they can retaliate economically. In the latter situation, courts, quite apart from the First Amendment opinions, don't want to be drawn into lawsuits that appear to have that as the ulterior purpose of that. But it's also, I'm not so sure that Bruce's characterization of there being a lack of civility on the internet is really the right way to characterize it. I think the lack close to something else, which is the often unwarranted assumption that because you're doing it on the internet, you get away with it. And underlying that assumption is a couple of things, including the fact that if I'm online with a handle, no one will find out who I am. That is a huge mistake, because 9 times out of 10, even without the benefit of a subpoena, there are ways to figure out through social engineering, alternatively pretext or otherwise, figuring out who's doing what to whom and why. And if you look at most of your terms of service with most of your internet service providers, you will see that none of them promise you any degree of anonymity. And moreover, almost all of them make it unlawful for you to engage in the sort of improper activities that we've been talking about. So just because you can do it online doesn't mean that you should do it online. And it raises a fundamental question about what people are thinking when they do this sort of thing, and therefore the consequences of being sued in a case where there's extreme behavior, don't frankly, is particularly unfortunate if in fact the behavior is extreme and wrongful, versus what is a bona fide or improper exercise of the court process to get back at an employee who may be disgruntled.
Okay. Well, I was going to comment, one more interesting phenomenon that we've observed in a number of cases, both in terms of the context of commercial problems and conflicts, or even personal fights, stalking cases, that the people who are on these chat sites most frequently are policing the chat sites. There has become self-regulation. And so you see a plethora of what is an outrageous statement made. It may not necessarily be defamatory, but it's a constant reiteration of the same accusations and allegations and their recklessness. You see this barrage of follow-on communications saying, get off, we don't like this anymore. You're crazy if you come in.
And the person coming in can't create 6 more identities to say, no, what Fred says, they have some.
But going back to is there are patterns of expressions that are like fingerprints, and you can't get away from them, and they're instinctive. So these people know we had stalking kids, and they did it, they changed their identities. And the community on the site said, we know what you do. You changed your pseudonym, but we still know you. Get off into the world. We broke them off the site.
One of the things that amazes me, and we've actually only been involved in 3 of these cases where we actually filed briefs and given advice to lots of other people online. What amazes me is the extent to which companies or the individuals who are plaintiffs seem to think of the lawsuit as their remedy. They don't speak. They don't get on the message. Anybody can go on the message board and say, this is all a pile of hooey. And
well, I'm the CEO, and honest, problems are just fine.
But you can put your information out that way and respond to it that way. And if somebody is saying something stupid for the benefit of anonymity, trust and not just tell anyone.
The problem with that is that it's not a level playing field. And you have one person in the conversation who has a face and identity, and the other who doesn't. Now, if the CEO gets on there and starts revealing information that's inside information, it's probably violating rules, regulations, and Securities and Exchange Commission. You're probably revealing information that's not generally available to the public, and his securities lawyer has probably told him, do not go on the internet, do not say anything on the internet. Because if you do, you're going to have enforcement against the SEC come down on you. So
Boeing has a new plane about to roll off the assembly line. The question is it airworthy? And they're still working on it, so they're not allowed, they don't want to say anything one way or the other. A bunch of people are saying, I hear it's about to crash. And then you're saying, well, you can't usually go on and say, no, everything's fine.
Even if they disagree or agree, it doesn't matter which side of the argument they take, they're revealing information which is not generally available to the public and creates all sorts of SEC problems.
Yeah. Well, would you say the same thing if a reporter published a story in the newspaper, the PR people couldn't respond to the newspaper? That's what you do that.
Well, I would probably that too, because I think these executives have a fiduciary responsibility to shareholders to make sure that there's accurate information out without can accommodate insider information about whether it's the SEC, but they simply have a duty to extend it possible, correct the record.
they do have that duty, but it's the manner in which they correct that information that's critical for SEC.
So the classic example I made is the pending merger on or off.
Yeah, then you put a press release out that's generally available to the public, and you put it on your website, everyone has access to it. You file it in your 10K or your 10Q, and you may be fine, but stick it on your page on the Yahoo message board, or maybe 100 or 200 people read it, maybe they're wrong.
But those aren't the only choices. And in fact, this points up something that helps separate meritorious suits from the non-meritorious suits. If, in fact, your only response is a targeted response on getting John or Jane Doe, it's quite to raise a smell about the lawsuit, frankly, as opposed to a bona fide response across the board, because if, in fact, the problem is a industry-wide problem or a public-wide problem about a particular company, then your response has to be on a public basis, and it will be part of the chapter response. It will also be part of the press release. It will be part of the analyst meeting. There will be lots of things that you will do as part of a bona fide response to a true problem for your company. It's the case where you do nothing else. But when the John or Jane Doe lawsuit is the only act taken in response to what was said, that raises real questions on the face of it about whether this is a bona fide lawsuit address a real harm to the company, which hurts the public shareholders as well, or whether it's an act of retaliation. So I would refer to people with greater SEC expertise than I do, but I can't believe that if you've got, in fact, rumors being circulated on the Yahoo message board, you cannot respond not only on the Yahoo message board, but as part of a coordinated public campaign to make sure that the public confidence in your company is restored if it's been harmed by these calls.
And Bruce, I thought that's what you recommend to your clients on your website.
What I recommend to the clients is that you disseminate it in a broad manner. For example, you might put a press release on the corporation's website, and then you may link it to the Yahoo Bulletin Board page so that a reader of the Yahoo Bulletin Board page, along with others in the world of leadership,
everybody's easily alerted to the problem.
To backtrack for a moment to get a sense of the stakes, when you file these suits, you get the name, maybe you can then proceed with the defamation case or any of the other causes of action we talked about. Is there actually money on the other side of the damages often available for the guy that says, come take my truck?
It depends upon the situation. It depends upon whether you have a competitor that's trying to put you out of business. We have a situation for El South Corporation. The fellow ended up to be the head of food services for Penn State University, claimed that he worked for the corporation, a list of barbels. He earned $33,000 a year, so what do you do? Well, we ended up doing that particular case because of his great criticism of women, of the chairman's wife, and the guy had an IQ, I think, of 164. We made him teach illiterate adults.
Did you subpoena that fact?
No, he told us about that.
Please say your IQ for the record.
You're very right. So he's now teaching illiterate adults how to read, and he's taking 25% of his earnings and donating them to women in distress in Pennsylvania.
And that's by court order or by settlement?
That was by settlement, and that was satisfactory to the CEO, and the CEO feels that the CEO is a constructive purpose from the region.
Now, you're sometimes also looking for an injunction that says that he will cease and desist from making any similar statements. Anyway.
Very difficult to get. Now, you have new act. There's new approaches to this, which you may have seen in your cases or not. Really, the Lanham Act is the only way that I know of.
This is not trademark targeting, sort of thing.
Well, yeah. I mean, what happens is sometimes people will put up a site to slam somebody, and they'll use that site to drive people there and then make money off them. So it's arguable under Lanham that it's a violation when the Lanham Act does provide a conjunctive relief. So it's you'll probably try to see
that. Thank you. He's got his research
agenda. Well, wait a second. Let me ask you about that. Because in order for there to be any conjunctive decree issued by a court in Lanham Act case, you've got to prove that the speech is commercial speech,
right,
in interstate commerce. What's the commercial nature of a
commercial nature is, I can give one particular case where, actually, it's the case that you focused on up there, the baseball case. The gentleman who sent you the letter.
This is Worldwide Scan.
Worldwide Scan has a site on the bottom there that is a competitive site that you can click on. Right? You have to go all the way to the bottom. I think, way again. Let's see, up a little bit. B-Store. Let's see, Worldwide Scan Internet Mall. Click on that. Okay, I want to put out. Okay, there's his Worldwide Scan Mall, which sells products, which is exactly like what the Bitsmart does. Violates the land. So, we, in all likelihood, the client decides to go about it, would be entitled to a job.
I'm sorry, I don't know about that. What triggers the violation of the land right here?
Well, it's the communication about the competitor, and that communication, the defamation about the competitor on the site, which causes people to go to this site and then buy the thing as opposed to the competitor.
I mean, a worldwide representation about the competitor. What's the false?
Well, I mean, I can spend an hour. Falsity is that the company is a scam, and the company is a criminal, the company violates all sorts of things.
So it's as if there were some, you know, Channel 7 News does an expose about Food Lion and how their meat is bad. By the way, if you want really good meat, come to Channel 7 News Deli.
This is the offshoot of the basic
method. What troubles me about it, this is getting into a very different area than the cybersphere it seems to be, but what troubles me about the example you're giving is, obviously, I want to look very quickly at the hyperlinks that he was going through, but it looked like what you had on the Worldwide Scam site was an ad. And what you seem to be saying is that because he has an ad which he uses to make money to support his non-commercial site, that therefore the site itself is covered by the Lanham Act. And it would be one thing, it seems to me, if it were the underlying site that was making the false comments, and quite another way, it's just a site with an ad. I mean, in one of the cases that we had somebody who had a gripe site about Trinity's. And she had a guest book, and the guest book had ads because those were the terms on which she was able to get a guest book feature on her website. And the company tried to make the ad, and the argument that made her a commercial site, which was subject to the Lanham Act in her criticisms and terminates. And that seems a little far-fetched. Now, this is different because this is his site rather than just a foreign site that he saw the ad for. But that, I find this really troubling.
Yeah, just to test it out, I went and bought a book for the site, crimes and misnomers, and the money did go to him. Actually, they sent me a box, and the box was empty, so I never got the book.
Wait, it's the Worldwide Scam Mall. You're one of your stats.
I have the box. It's in my home.
Some questions?
Basically, everything we've been talking about assumes that you can somehow find out the identity of the person, either through a subpoena, assuming that they're actually using their ISP, or if you're entrapping them. What happens when you can't? So, is there any way to actually enforce judgment against the person whose name you can't find, either because maybe they're only using public terminals, maybe they're using somebody else's computer without their knowledge, and how does that work?
The answer is no. And this is really the problem. The only remedy that you have if you're an injured party at that juncture is public relations. Because if you use the courts, you have to name someone. And if you can't name them, you can't get a judgment. You can't get any relief from the courts. And we are finding more and more that people are using anonymizing services. And what that will force is a change in legislation. To create some sense of tracking and or responsibility. And that also raises all sorts of other issues as it balances with the issue of privacy on the net, which is a big issue right now.
You mean your claim is that ISPs could in the future not carry packets from people who have not properly identified themselves?
I think what you're implying in Congress in the future is that in exchange for the limited immunity that's granted under the Communications Decency Act, the ISPs will be required to keep some sense of information about who's using their services, and thus make you track them. I think that's what you're going to see with the development of the
products.
This might be a useful time, Bob. I'm sorry, go ahead.
I have a follow-up question.
Yeah, sure.
First, excuse me, false representations to the ISP. And it seems like you're going to have to put more, much greater burden on the ISP. They're going to have to somehow have some burden of investigation.
The ISP should not have the burden of policing. I think that would put the Yahoo's, the AOLs out of business. But, for example, if you take Yahoo, in order to sign up for Yahoo, you have to give them certain information. Yahoo could be required, or they can require themselves, information which is not false in order to use their service. And if you gave them that information, they preserve that information so that it may be used in response to a subpoena, that would solve the problem and no policing would be necessary.
Now, of course, we have two examples so far of possible combinations of technological and regulatory schemes that do it. ICANN just through an election and had to do it over the internet by and large and had to figure out how not to have a dozen people's dogs registered as voters around the world. And came up with a Byzantine combination of PIN systems and paper mail sent to addresses for which fraud was possible, but more costly than just signing up and giving bogus information. We also, of course, have been talking about the advent of digital signature technology, and with that, the ability to make declarative statements about yourself in cooperation with relevant, trusted third parties that people know are authentic. So maybe you would have to present some evidence from someone that you are a particular person or you live in this address, where your identity has been warehoused somewhere. It's safe somewhere, and if a suit is to happen, we will know how to get it if, in fact, it gets passed the judge. To say that it has to be disclosed under subpoena.
I would be very surprised if that legislation is through any Congress in the near future. And I would be even more surprised if any ISP voluntarily changes the system to force greater disclosure, because it's just not in the business interest of any ISP that doesn't otherwise want to do it to change their techniques. I would think you have to see a lot more abuse of the internet than we've seen today, and demonstrate institutional incapability of the courts to fix the problem before you see legislation. You may see it proposed, but unless the courts suddenly throw their hands and we can deal with this, I would not think that that's going to be the outcome.
Is there anybody on the panel who read the IRC Ohio today would want to try to apply it to a kind of law, whatever its political chances, that would create a safe harbor for ISPs who go to some lengths to determine the identities of the people who sign up to use
them? Yeah,
same. The mics are dying. You got a shout.
Okay. Also, the case was about Mrs. McIntyre who distributed without signing them, and there was this Ohio law who basically required to be signed by the name of the person who brings them and distributes them. And essentially, the Supreme Court said that the distribution was not distribution because of having freedom of speech. Relied on the previous cases, which basically said that the freedom to anonymously publish your name public your political piece is one of the safeguards of the First Amendment.
So my point,
the problem is yes. With regard to our cases, all the cases were about either elections or referendums, so politics in the state sense. So far, none of them was about information or private companies like companies, corporations.
So if the law said all those who advertise products must somewhere within the ad identify who they are, it's not clear to you that McIntyre would apply.
It's not clear. It is possible, though. I mean, you would argue that the case law enlarged the ability of the First Amendment, because in a previous case, on the 70s, said that this applies only to election candidates. McIntyre was surviving largely including also referendum issues. So you could argue that eventually it can go from the street politics to other areas. But I mean, it isn't clear. You could also say that, I mean, the court says at the end, before the previous case, that in such cases, you have to give greater weight to the value of free speech than to the interest of the species. But in so far, it's part of the question.
I've been worried about that too. I haven't seen any of the my adversaries so sophisticated enough to raise that argument. Please don't tell them. Although I suppose if Martin's here, he'll be passing it out. Can you hear me? One thing that I thought of, and I thought about that on the plane on the way up, I believe that one of the cases that cited McIntyre, Tally, California, actually involved. It was a very political kind of commercial leaflet, but it was a, there were leaflets that, as I recall, were calling for the boycotts of businesses that discriminated. So that's at least a form of economic action now. It's very political economic action, obviously. But, so I would certainly, if my recollection of Tally is correct, I would use that as a basis for saying that, yes, although McIntyre obviously was a political leaflet case, the principle is just confined.
The issue of McIntyre was raised both in the lower court and the appellate court in the VA situation. The Judge Chopp in the lower court made a ruling that there was a difference between political speech and economic speech. The issue was also raised in briefs in the Third District Court of Appeals. And although the opinion doesn't specifically comment on it, I think that clearly the Third District would have been influenced in a different way had we been dealing with elections or political speech.
I really have to take exception with the way you keep characterizing the decisions in the VA case as rulings and opinions and so forth. The Third District Court of Appeal handed down a one line or one sentence refusal to take refusal to grant cert. And the
man can quote them.
Yeah, you know, this is a great victory for Bruce in this case, there's no question. But the attributing presidential significance, for example, to the transcript of a judge who's engaging in a dialogue with the lawyers and then issues an order which doesn't have a written explanation, I think is a bit problematic. Okay. And that's, when you refer to what Judge Shockin, if I'm remembering her name correctly, when you're referring to her ruling, what you're referring to, I think, I haven't seen the transcript itself, but looking at your appellate brief, it looked as if you were taking excerpts from her colloquy with lawyers who were arguing the case and treating what she said in that colloquy as her opinion. And I think that's very chancy. As one who does lots of oral arguments on appeal and otherwise, I find judges often sort of play with their thoughts about the case and then write an opinion which may be very different from what I thought they were going to say.
The judge in that case said to the American Civil Liberties Union, don't bring me cases dealing with political speech. That was pretty clear.
So we'll have to let the class be the jury on that one. But is it your sense then, Paul, that basically the issue has not been fully joined yet? But there's basically no real cases of sort of opinions coming down that have just determined the boundaries.
But I haven't seen any reported case. There's a case involving a trademark domain name suit called Seeds Candy, which is reported, but which isn't about cybersphere.
Yeah.
There is a case, although it doesn't deal with the First Amendment, it deals with the Fourth Amendment issues. That case is U.S. versus Hambrick at 55 F. Supp. 2nd 504, W.D. Virginia 1999. In that particular case, there was an analysis done by the court of whether there was a reasonable or legitimate expectation of privacy to one's information given to an internet provider based on the objectively reasonable standard. And the court found that, in fact, once you give up your information to a party you contract with, such as Yahoo, you have no legitimate expectation of privacy based on the objectively reasonable standard. And the motion to quash the subpoena in that case was denied.
So, So if you were just momentarily finding yourself on the other side, somebody actually called you, they're in trouble, money is no object, they need not to have their identity revealed, you've got to write this motion to quash. What's the best argument for you, or what's the kind of best case for you to make that statement that...
What your argument is?
Yeah, that's what I'm curious
about. It's hard for me to do that. I think what I would argue is that we're dealing with First Amendment issues, we're not dealing with Fourth Amendment issues. That the, and these things were in fact argued in the Third District Court of Appeals, that the right to anonymity is time honored in the United States, and there's no division between political and economic speech, and it should be elevated to a greater protection on the internet than elsewhere in society. Now, this is what I would argue. We have a transcript here and not a letter. So I'm not quoting.
Another thing I would say about Hammerick is that it wasn't the motion to quash his subpoena. The question was the validity of his conviction. And the question was whether a search of his premises was a violation of the Fourth Amendment. And one of the ways they had got the information that led to the search of his premises was by sending a subpoena to the ISP, which willingly provided the information. And the question was whether going through that process led to an ultimate violation of the Fourth Amendment right, which seems to me raises very different
questions.
Yeah. Basically, the answer to the question is yes.
So we're running out of time. Perry, let me just ask you, is it your sense, at this moment in time, as a technical matter, if somebody is going to effort to hide, they're not making the misjudgment, in their view, to give Yahoo identifiable information. They're using anonymized, maybe. What are your odds of tracking that person down? If somebody says to you, money's no object, we've got to find out who this person is. We'll hire lawyers if we need to. We'll hire former NSA employees if we need to. We'll hire Simpson if we need to. What are the odds of tracking?
Well, given enough resources, I think the odds are fairly good, because these people do not act, for the most part, as sole practitioners. They are in communication with other people. And in the case that I cited before, one of the ways we were ultimately able to identify the individual who was the plaintiff and who impersonated the chairman was because he was calling up other known short sellers and broker-dealers and communicating with them and trying to get them interested in taking the same kind of decision. Now, I want to make one final point if I could. About 10 years ago, we were investigating short sellers who were going around spreading false information to the news media that the FBI was conducting investigations of specific companies, that there were organized crime fronts, and then the newspapers would call the FBI and they would say, we can't comment on anything like that, and then they'd run an article and the stock would begin to on, but not with the velocity that we're seeing in the internet today. And I think the major mischief here is by targeting companies with very little infrastructure, by not having the SEC Enforcement Division technologically current with what's going on, and leaving it to the private sector to try to protect themselves, we're going to have this constant to and fro on the privacy issue of identification of individuals. By the time this gets resolved, we may have, as we have, huge destabilization of very important economic interests. And I think that's the real danger, that the velocity of information, the rapidity by which it can get transmitted, is impacting negatively on these things. But given enough time and given enough resources, we can
identify. So we've been blessed with four people today who, lawyers all, I know this is sort of a career time for many of you, this quiet week rooms. Lawyers all are, one, totally in the zone as regards to the subject. These guys are on the front lines, every one of them, in different ways, and know this stuff inside and out, as I think you've noticed. There are also people who represent such interesting different sectors of work. .org, .com, .spy, people who are finding different ways to express their lawyerly talent. So I encourage you to have time, not only in a moment to join me in thanking them wholeheartedly for illuminating our class, but Sarah, do we actually have a cold cut? There are cold cuts out there. Please don't make us have leftovers for a while. Rebecca has a question before we finish our thanks or something to say.
Because the reality is that there are not cold cuts enough for everyone.
So I ask each of you to introspect and see whether you really earned the cold cut.